and this is Alan Minsky, and this is The People's Game. Digital Village is off this week, this holiday weekend, and they will be back next week. The People's Game is KPFK Radio and Pacifica Radio's World Cup 2010 soccer show, in a show that we look at the action on the field, and we also talk about the political, cultural, and economic subtext of the world's most popular cultural event. Now, the big news today, of course, is that Argentina and Germany just finished their match about an hour ago, and it was a stunning result, with Germany eliminating one of the tournament favorites 4-0. I'm joined live in studio by
Pablo Morales.
And Pablo Morales is the man behind a film, a documentary film in production called Gringos at the Gate, about the United States and Mexico's soccer rivalry. And we are also joined on the phone by Jennifer Doyle, our co-host on the show. And Jennifer has a fantastic blog you all should check out called From a Left Wing. Welcome to the show, Jennifer.
Thank you.
And let's begin with today's action on the field. Of course, we'll talk later about the Paraguay-Spain match that kicks off in about an hour and a half. Maybe we'll reflect back a little bit on yesterday's action. But wow, 4-0. Germany over Argentina. Jennifer, let's start with you. Your thoughts.
I have been combing through some of the writings of my favorite bloggers, and so I'm actually going to share with you a description of the game from FootFanatico.com, and this blogger draws a comparison between losing to Germany and basically being the victim in a horror movie. Basically, I'm just going to read you a couple lines. So, from the audience perspective, the German counterattacks play like a creepy killer, carefully entering and walking through the house. As the masked villain slowly tiptoes down the hallway towards the bedroom, we flash to the scene of an impervious back line taking a shower. Will Hines step in to rule Podolski offside? Oh, no. He's decided to use conditioner, and he can't hear the killer turning the door handle to the bedroom. And he continues on. And it was a little bit like this. Now, I actually don't want to describe Germany as a horror show because their game was too beautiful. But it was a bit of a slaughter from the Argentinian perspective. They just seemed completely unprepared for this attacking, quick, imaginative game that Germany brought to the field today. And it was sort of a shame because I feel like we really didn't get to see the Argentina that we all want to see, but really that's the point of the game, is to prevent your opponent from getting to play their game. So kudos and hats off to Germany. They just played a wonderful game, and I think they've earned a whole new generation of fans today with this incredible performance.
And Jennifer, we actually have on the line somebody who watched the game with, I believe, 900 people at the Alpine Village in Torrance. And I want to say before we welcome this person on to the line that also at the Goethe Institute on Wilshire in central Los Angeles, they had about 250 people. We spoke to the people from the Goethe Institute, and everybody left in a caravan of celebration following Germany's victory. And now we're joined on the line by one of the people who watched the match down at Alpine Village. German fan, introduce yourself to the Southern California listeners here on KPFK.
I'm Josephine Schmidt. I'm a bartender at Alpine Village. I was very busy. I didn't have too much time to watch the game.
Ah, well, what was the scene?
The atmosphere was very great. Everybody yelling, screaming, and waving their German flag. And we had everybody was singing and having a good time. And they repeat, I saw the goals, but yeah, we were almost 1,000 people in here, you know, everybody upstairs, downstairs, full standing room only, drinking beer, having a good time.
It's a good way to start a morning.
Yeah. I came at 6 o'clock, and right away people were waiting already for me.
And so 6 o'clock at Alpine Village, which is in Torrance, and it is 833 Torrance Boulevard. And Alpine Village, about 1,000 people there, beginning at about 6 o'clock. And 3 minutes into the game, the party must have sort of hit a new plateau.
Oh, yeah. Everybody was screaming. And we have all the big pitchers and beer. And they were, you know, I couldn't. They're screaming. I run out of glasses, you know. Big screen and singing and everybody having a good time.
And in 2006, of course, Germany hosted the World Cup. How was that in 2006 at the Alpine Village?
I don't think it was that crazy than this time.
So this time even more?
Yeah, I mean, there were really a lot of fans here today. I mean, I I have seen it on New Year's Eve crowded like that, but not...
And it seems to me that maybe that Germany has picked up more fans, even among Germans. I, you know, not to say that the team has ever been unpopular, but it does seem as though they've really have a new wind in their sails and are appealing to a different, an expanded sense of community, which is good to see.
Yeah, and also I think the 2006 World Cup in Germany was put on so positively that I think it really must attract people to do things like go to Alpine Village, go to the Goethe Institute, to watch these things collectively, because one of the lasting images from 2006 were these fantastic street festivals in the beautiful German summer. And it was all so peaceful and so beautiful and so well laid out. Well, thank you so much for joining us here from the Alpine Village. And one final question, is the sentiment down there that this team is just really on its way?
Yeah, I feel like they're really on this way. I didn't expect it because Argentina is such a tough competitor and have one of the best players in there, you know?
Well, Germany did a fantastic job in terms of their defensive strategy.
It was a big surprise. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you.
Great. Thank you.
And let me just remind people then, just finally, that at Alpine Village, of course, Wednesday, midday, is when the semifinal will take place, and Germany will play either Paraguay or Spain.
Games. We have all the... upstairs and downstairs, all the TVs, we show all the games.
So there'll be games there, of course, later today at 11:30, and there'll be a game...
11:30, the next one, yes.
And then Tuesday, there'll be
I don't think it will be as crowded as the German one.
No, and Germany takes the field again on Wednesday, so that will be something else. And thank you so much for joining us again from Alpine Village.
Have a nice day. Bye.
You too. Thank you. Bye-bye. Jennifer, tactically... You go into a match, Germany versus Argentina. Everybody in the world basically understands how Messi plays. I mean, he's low to the ground. He's the weeble and the wobble who doesn't fall down. And Germany has defenders that are, besides Lahm, all over 6 feet tall, 6 foot six, in fact. And you think, okay, this is what they're going to do. They're going to attack on the ground. There was no space. I don't really think they ever had a decent challenge on goal in the whole game. I mean, Germany just clogged them.
Yeah, I mean, it was Germany didn't really, I mean, Argentina, rather, didn't seem to have much going on down the wings. I don't know if that seemed to maybe be some of the problem, but Germany came out wanting the game more. I mean, I don't think there was a first second, right up until even when they were three up to nothing, you know, with 5 minutes left in the game, Germany was still, you know, pedal to the metal, putting it all in. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that Germany just wanted it more. I think that too. There's some questions about the decisions that Maradona made in terms of the selection. But even so, I'm not sure there's any particular decision that he could have made that would have won the game. You know, might have gotten them a goal or two. But to my mind, there was basically no stopping the German side today, and they were just pretty much the better team by any way that you might measure that.
Yeah, I think a lot of it just seemed... I remember that final close-up of Maradona just before the final whistle where he's holding his... It looks like some sort of silver rosary or some religious token. And I was thinking, you know, it takes more than just faith to win at the highest level international football. And, you know, the Germans came out so organized. They had an obvious game plan. They always had two men deep in the middle. So wherever the whether it's Messi or Tevez, but primarily Messi would receive the ball, he might beat the first guy, he might beat the second guy, but by then there's three, and there was just no room. And without his playmakers at Barcelona of Xavi or Iniesta to get that quick back pass to open it up and spring something going, without that central midfield playmaker behind Messi, he's just not effective. And eventually, as the game went on, he was getting the ball at the start of the game. It was the top of the box. By the halfway through the midfield, it was 30 yards out. By the beginning of the second half, he was collecting the ball in his own half, and he still puts his head down and dribbles because that's what he does. And you know, you just can't do that again. Well, you know, Maradona could do that against England in 1986, but you know, Messi is, as I think we'd all agree, is not that kind of total footballer the way that Maradona was. And he just couldn't do it by osmosis from the sidelines.
Yeah, I think the case of Messi points to something that was pointed out by another blogger I've been reading, whom I really admire. He has a blog called it's called Run of Play, and there was an article on that blog by Brian Phillips at the end of June, just pointing up that you can't identify the greatest footballer in the world without also identifying the context within which he plays.
Yeah.
So when Messi is playing within, you know, Barcelona, that's one story. And when he's playing within, you know, Argentina, you're not seeing Messi's full potential. And I would even go as far to say that with Maradona and the Argentinian side that he was playing in when he played in the World Cup, that part of Maradona's story was his relationship to the team and whatever those conditions of possibility were, you know, that allowed him to flourish as an individual are not there for the kind of player that Messi is and for Argentina and the team that it is today. Football really is a team game, and you know, you saw these incredible performances from Klose, from you know, a number of the German players. Who's the playmaker, the midfielder in, for Germany?
Schweinsteiger.
Yes, I mean that he is just an absolutely brilliant and marvelous player.
Mm-hmm.
But what he's doing is he's making things happen for everyone else. I mean, for me, he's you know, he's the man of the match, and you can't. You know, the Messi Maradona alliance is actually, when you think about it, it's almost like an albatross hung around the team's neck. That kind of expectation that be either the single, you know, figure of the coach kind of transmitted through the body of Messi. It's a fantasy. I don't think that's
you know, in the end of the day, coaches don't win games. I mean, that's one of the, you know, the great fallacies of, you know, like the Mourinho and others who think, you know, all you need is the right manager. I mean, in the United States, you talk about, you know, the Laker coach and his overall success. But if you took away the great players, you know, you don't win championships. And you have to have the right chemistry. And, yeah, there was a lot of questions about who was left behind in terms of the really solid midfielders of, like, Cambiaso and Zanetti, although Zanetti more of a fullback, but Cambiaso for sure, or Riquelme. Who just had conflicts with the ego that is Diego Maradona. And, you know, you could say, what if, maybe, could have been. But then you look at you look at Germany and here this young squad playing for each other, obviously a team with a plan and executing it well with discipline. And, you know, yeah, take everything out. And that's the difference.
Well, the thing, too, that I thought a big part of it was with Verón not playing, because if you looked at how, I mean, he's the one guy on the Argentinian team who can just, who does play a classic midfield distribution role. He wasn't on the field today, and I think he wasn't there because he's simply viewed as too old and too slow to keep up with the Germans today.
Mm.
And then that goes back to, well, Riquelme's not on the team because he has a conflict with Maradona,
right,
who would be young enough to start even against Germany. So Verón wasn't there, and you just didn't see anybody distributing the ball creatively on behalf of Argentina. And so everything was pretty much, again, just trying to barrel their way through the middle, whether it was Tevez or Messi, and it was clogged, and the Germans defended it brilliantly. Again, you know, Cambiaso, Zanetti, Riquelme, Verón, Samuel's out, and, of course, they didn't play Milito up front. All that said, I don't know who beats the Germans today. And, in fact, Argentina succeeded in doing one thing today. They made England look damn good. England was able to come back and get a goal and actually quite clearly a second goal and even tie back. They showed, again, offensive firepower, which again shows the sort of tragedy of the English side, because they do have that capacity to create and make the one thing that there's a total premium on, which is goals in a World Cup final. And yet, but Germany, just Germany, that's it. This team is something else. And Joachim Löw, I mean, my word. I mean, what cohesion.
Yeah, and you wanted to make a point, Jennifer, about what might have led to this cohesion.
I mean, I have no idea if this plays a part in it, but today I found myself remembering that in early November, you know, Germany lost its the man who was very likely to be the starting keeper. I mean, you never know because a lot happens in the months leading up to the World Cup. Robert Enke, who committed suicide. And I was actually had been in Germany right around just about a week before this happened, and so I was in a lot of contact with people in Berlin and also in Europe who are sort of football fans. I can't tell you what a terrible story this was for European football very broadly, but the Germans in particular. I mean, it was a very, very, very sad story, and he'd struggled with depression across his career, and he'd fought really hard for his spot on the team, and he played in clubs in Portugal, Spain, Turkey, and finally in the Bundesliga for Hannover. He had won 8 caps for Germany before he died, and he was really well positioned to be the number one keeper. And his wife actually came out very, very shortly after his death and spoke about his struggles with depression and the pretty much heroic effort that he had fought throughout his career to overcome clinical depression, which is a very serious illness, in order to, you know, be the best athlete that he could be. And, you know, the outpouring of grief in November was very, very, very moving. You know, and as you can imagine, the team, the whole organization for the National Club was just absolutely devastated. And I found myself wondering to what degree this as a kind of background in the year leading up to the World Cup might have actually put things in perspective for the immediate community of athletes who had, you know, lost a, you know, member, a member of their community.
Well, you know, a death of an athlete to a team, actually, you just don't know how it's going to affect the team. It could be in a negative or it could be in a positive. It just depends on how it's portrayed. And that public ceremony they had for him, I remember in Germany the day where the entire German national team, Dirk Kaiser, all the former players of the national team, it was a sense of unity that I was thinking when it was all over. It wasn't like it was shameful. Suicide can sometimes be seen as shameful, but this was seen as some sort of a tragic loss. And I think soccer history is full of teams that have bounced back from such tragedies and really created some sort of a deep unity and purpose, you know, that they may not have had.
I mean, I found myself thinking in looking back on it, in November, I wrote about this on my blog, how something like that actually puts the macho sort of win-at-all-cost worldview, the intolerance for the possibilities of failure, right, the disgust that sports culture shows for vulnerability. It basically completely swept that stuff aside, and so for a moment you saw basically the sports media really looking quite directly in the face of some very real and difficult issues about what it means to be a competitive athlete at that level, about the relationship between depression and athleticism and at the highest levels of competition, because it's been shown that actually sometimes people almost organically seek out intense sports as a way of combating depression. So this is more common, actually, at the highest levels of competition than one might expect in terms of, you know, just there was just a sense of community and an interpersonal connection that formed around his loss in the fall. And I don't know if, again, you can't say the difference between that and this, but how could there not be on some level?
I think you could definitely draw something from it. And it also is interesting, at least from, you know, at the beginning of the show, Alan was talking to this German fan, talking about 2006, and I remember going into 2006 with a pretty a genetic bias against Germany, having a Dutch mother and an Argentine father, but I fell in love with the German fans and the population, and got swept up in their sort of newfound pride in their national identity. And I think this young team in this World Cup, a lot of whom are actually two cup veterans, you know, help kind of like continue the positiveness. I mean, that was a very positive game for a German team that stifled what, you know, is in the end of the day, player for player, a more creative team in Argentina. And you just can't hate that. You just can't, you know, look down on that. They were cynical. They were brutal. They weren't. They did a very good job. I'll use the word again. They were disciplined. They didn't have a lot of holes in their back. Their back line. And for a team that has totally shown the world how to execute a good fast break.
Well, we're gonna be joined in a second by Maria.
I just wanted to let you know. I just got a text from a friend in Berlin who's telling me that Kreuzberg, which is the Turkish neighborhood in Berlin, is in particular going crazy. And that's in celebration of Germany doing well with Özil on the squad and representing this new generation of German players. So I thought listeners might want to know that.
in a moment, we're going to be joined by Maria Poble, who is Argentinian, and we'll be talking obviously about Argentina. She's also a progressive organizer and somebody who organizes left soccer teams and leagues around the country. So that's going to be an interesting conversation. But I wanted, before we leave Germany, I actually want to refer people back to the interview that aired on Beneath the Surface yesterday at 5 p.m. on KPFK with Thomas Gagan. Thomas Gagan has a new book out about the European economic and social model, And in that interview, we talk about the structure of the Bundesliga. Now, everybody out there who's a soccer fan, really follows soccer closely, would know that Manchester United and Liverpool, the fans were in revolt against the ownership, calling upon the fans to retake ownership of the clubs, which is what traditionally how clubs were owned. And in the Bundesliga, the rule is that 50% plus one, so always the majority of every club, is owned by the actual local club members. Okay, and one of the things I think, okay, that's a great thing, first of all.
Right.
Secondly, and there was a challenge, by the way, by companies like Red Bull to change this rule in 2008, and fortunately it got defeated. And you see these clubs, you know, they go sky high with all this infusion of capital or foreign money or great amounts of investment money, and then they crash and burn, you know, all in the course of a few months sometimes, and of course that's what the ups and downs of finance capitalism these days, not in the Bundesliga. And I think this is also part of the subtext to the greatness of this young German team, is that people, these clubs in Germany, they don't compete for the top A-list players. Except for Bayern Munich, you don't really have any clubs really attracting the top players. Once they reach that level, they're bought up by a premiership club, Serie A still a little bit, and La Liga club, right? Those are the three top leagues. The Bundesliga sort of is fourth. And so there's an anonymity, and there was low expectations on account of this with some of these young German players, and they're unbelievably fantastic. And the fact that this is these clubs are owned locally means there's a real development of local talent, and it's really, I think that's part of the subtext of the success of the German side.
Oh, absolutely. And I also think that the reaction to the fans in general for if you look like what happened in Italy yesterday with the changing of the rules in Serie A for foreign players, the look for the scapegoats, Germans, they don't have that to worry about. They own the team. They support the team. They have the highest attendance at domestic home games in Europe. And they know who the fault of any bad performance is. It's themselves and how they run their own system.
And not surprisingly, on top of that, they're a somewhat worker-friendly league, and that all the other leagues are envious of the major leagues that they have a break in midwinter, so they get some rest.
I do want to bring things back to Robert Enke for a moment, because I've just been pulling up newspaper articles about the role that his memory is playing in the squad, the current squad. And this is a quote from Michael Ballack, and which is to say that in Enke's suicide note, basically, he said that he didn't seek out treatment because he was afraid of losing his place on the squad if he had himself committed to a psychiatric clinic. And so Ballack says he was scared to speak about his problem because he was scared to lose his child or his job, or to confess to having a weakness to other players. People have weaknesses, and we should accept it. This should never be forgotten. It was a hard time for everyone close to him and for us as players. He will always have a place in the team. The players, the staff, the management all knew him, and it's still in our minds and in the fans' minds. The further Germany go in the tournament, the more emotional it will get.
Well, it was great to see Ballack in the stands, obviously, today as well. And he's a really he really was a shock to the British press, Ballack, in terms of how outspoken and clear and honest he always was in the press. And that certainly is reflected in a beautiful passage you just read about the former German goalkeeper, recent German goalkeeper, who committed suicide. Right. Well, thank you for that, Jennifer. Please stay on with us, Jennifer. And we're going to now be joined by Maria Poblet, who is an organizer from the Bay Area. And she plays on a leftist soccer team that plants seeds around the country and develops other leftist soccer teams. She also is a partisan for the side of from her native country of Argentina. Maria, welcome to the People's Game.
Thank you. It's Poblet.
Poblet. Thank you.
Yeah.
And tough day for Argentinians.
Yeah, it was carnage. It was a really bad game to watch, and now we are in solidarity with a lot of people that watch their countries finally have the world stage, finally have the world watching them, and thousands or millions of people rooting for them, finally, and then lose, which is just heartbreaking. But as a leftist, I'm familiar with that. Millions of people on our side, and still we can't work out the right strategy.
Now, your team, too, Argentina, and we can talk about the details of the side in a moment. But among other things, this was a team that maybe more than any other team in the tournament had some explicitly radical left iconography associated with it. What did that mean to you? Yeah, what does that mean to you as both a leftist and an Argentinian?
I mean, it's a beautiful thing to watch Argentine people be on the world stage and use it for the cause of justice. So Maradona led the team in a lot of public support for the Madres de Plaza de Mayo that fought the dictatorship and that remain active in the struggle against imperialism even today. The whole team supported them as a nominee for the Nobel Peace Prize. And that was amazing to watch. Maradona, of course, is a controversial figure because he has been in a fight with the FIFA since he was a player about he was one of the first players to fight for African teams to have their own number of berths to get into the World Cup rather than having to compete with Europe. And as a result, there's been now a couple World Cups where a lot more African teams get to play on the world stage and get to get that level of training and skills. And this is an underdog team, despite actually having won at many times on the world stage. It's still a team where all the best players play in Europe because Argentina is not a country that economically can support leagues in the way that Spain can or England or Italy. And so we're an underdog in that sense of the political economy. And that's also a familiar situation as a leftist. So it's great to see the team bring that political identity and that experience to the world stage. And it's a good lesson for leftists who actually need to create a strategy. You know, how do we, okay, the best offense is actually not a good defense. You need a good defense, too.
we
got to remain, you know, you got to fight and win rent control and labor protections. You need the basic defense in addition to the offense, in addition to Venezuela, you know, nationalizing oil and things like that. You also need to win rent control in the Mission District in San Francisco, that kind of stuff.
Hear, hear. Mm-hmm. Hear, I love the good offense for the left. It's much needed, and it's a great call. And we'll talk about the soccer team you play on up there and the other leftist teams around the country. But returning back to the side, what's your analysis of what went wrong for a team that obviously did have an exceptional amount of on-field talent?
I think there's people who are better suited for the analysis. I know that I'm heartbroken.
Mm-hmm.
I know that the team actually needed to gel more as a team and that all the players playing in Europe makes that impossible, and that's a real detriment to the team. And I really wanted Maradona to redeem himself, but the odds were stacked against him. He wanted to jump in the field and play, and that's not the role of a coach. But he's scrappy, and you got to love him for that. He keeps talking about the players should unionize, and that's good.
Yeah, no, he's a lifelong subversive and oftentimes, especially in recent years, an outspoken leftist, and was throughout his career actually calling for player unions.
Yeah, and it's just sad to see the defense fall apart like that. And there's a few players that I would have liked to have seen. You know, I think Devis gave it his all, but I was waiting for Messi or Higuain to show up. I was sad that Verón didn't step on the pitch.
Right.
Riquelme actually never made it to the squad based on some squabbles, and I think that was a big loss way early on.
Right, right. No, it's sort of funny. Our a woman here who's been on the show, the former Free Speech Radio News anchor woman, Aura Bogado, who's Argentinian, and she loves the team, completely supported it, but Riquelme was her favorite player. So you'd go to her page, her Facebook page recently, and there was Riquelme's shirt, part of the paradox of being an Argentinian fan in this era with so many. I mean, there are 40 players from Argentina who would easily have fit on almost any national side. So while it's true Maradona had conflicts, there was a wealth of different players to select from. Well, tell us a little bit about the team you play on up in the Bay Area, Maria.
A few years ago, I helped to start the Left Wing Football Club that plays still every Sunday. It's been several years now, and there's a whole new crop of players. I'm actually out with an injury, but everybody keeps playing. They have a great time. It's really based on the idea that teamwork and sports actually can help bring people together and build a movement and build a culture of healthy and kind of constructive competition, where actually doing battle against a worthy opponent builds your skills, and that's a good thing for the left to learn. So it's been many years. They still play every Sunday. It's mixed men, women, trans people. We try to balance it out based on skills so that both teams have equal numbers of people who are very skilled and people who are new or not very skilled and actually have a great time. And just, I think last month, there was Copa Comunidad, where the Futbolistas Club from Los Angeles
mm-hmm.
came up, and there was a whole tournament that happened between both those teams, and the Futbolistas were in part inspired by our experience up here to start their team, and now there is a revolutionary Futbolistas in New York that actually spawned more recently, too.
I remember back in sort of the heydays of the counter-globalization movement back in, what was it, around 99 to 2001, there was a anarchist versus communist team battle up in the Bay Area. Do you remember that? Were you around for that?
I instigated that.
And which side did you play for?
Well, history has rewritten this. We started as anti-imperialist football club, but then in traditional leftist fashion, there was like a section that broke off or that created to say, you're not left enough, and we're going to fight with you. And then that quickly became anarchist versus socialist. And to give them credit, the anarchists won the football tournament. That is true. But all of the anarchists who were very serious about football quickly joined the left-wing football club, because as soon as the tournament was over, the anarchist football team fell apart because they had formed only to oppose the socialists, who had actually built an institution that still exists.
Now, how do you connect up, obviously, a left movement, a fully blooming left movement is about empowerment for all the peoples of the world, okay? Well, the most popular thing in the world right now, sadly, is not left politics, but is in fact global football. how do you riff off of those two elements, and how do you think they may relate, so sort of in a macro social manner?
Well, I think that what it takes to win in a football game is what it takes to win in the movement that we're trying to build. You know, I talk about this all the time in the organizing work that I do. Is that actually you need people that are going to fight to defend the gains that the social movements have won, the very basic things like wage protections and basic human rights. You also need advances. You need people who are going to find where there's an opening and try and win some new gains. You need some people making bold moves like nationalization of oil or the rights that Mother Earth has in the Constitution in Uruguay. Like, you need those things. And then you need the midfield. You need a connection between the defensive fights and the fights that are more proactive. And you need to take turns. You need coaches thinking about what you do when and who goes in when. And that's a useful lesson for the left that in the U.S. has been so discombobulated, and worldwide, too. I have just come from the U.S. Social Forum in Detroit, and there were 18,000 people there saying, let's all be on the same team. And that's a huge step for the U.S. left, and it's a huge contribution to the more advanced sectors of the left, like in Latin America and in places that are actually fighting for what they want and for what we would like the world to be, that we could actually connect, that we're actually present on the world stage in that way, is a huge step.
How did the World Cup play at the U.S. Social Forum? Were a lot of people enthusiastic following it, talking about it, relating it to global politics?
Oh, yeah. There was a workshop that Dave Zirin was on talking about the World Cup. There were several places that showed the cup. There was jerseys of different kinds throughout the cup. It wasn't a full gathering of football fans, but that's okay. You know, we'll let some not football fans.
I wanted to point out that the kind of footballing community that you're describing, I also participate in one that is, it's not a political one, it's a social one, but it does have, I think, an ethics that we try to enact in our games. I wanted to point out that your game is it's not segregated by gender. I don't like using that term co-ed, but this is you're playing mixed football, as it's called in England. And I actually think that often in those kinds of environments, a feminist ethic starts to unfold between players. It can develop a kind of awareness about the differences between styles of play and modes of communication that are incredibly useful for developing one's skills as an organizer within a social movement. So these are great laboratories, in a way, these kinds of footballing communities for doing work off the field.
Yeah, absolutely. We had a logo that had the man-woman, the man symbol, the woman symbol, and the trans symbol. That was actually our logo. And then in the negotiations on the field, always, of like, okay, so does it feel good? Are people learning? Are people growing? What are people's observations about what's working and not working? It's very It's very interesting and insightful. And it builds a level of camaraderie that you need in order to address things as profound as the way that patriarchy plays out in social settings among people who would agree on the goals of, like, oh, yeah, we want to build a movement. We want to win this game. But then, you know, the history of oppression gets in the way. So how do you deal with that? It's true that that's a transformative moment.
Yeah, we, you know, one of the things we try to raise a lot of issues here about, you know, the fact this is, we call it the people's game. It's been traditionally a source of great social solidarity among the working class, among in many anti-colonial struggles, and, you know, the co-option of it by sort of, you know, mass spectacle global capitalism is in full effect. And, of course, very interested in every strategy from the grassroots to the macrocosm of taking the game back for the people. Maria, what do you think about a call for an international strike for the 2014 World Cup? Everybody gets the first 2 weeks of the tournament off globally.
Wow. I haven't heard about that. It's called strikes.
I think you just made it up just now.
Oh, no. I did a few episodes ago, installments ago. I'm all for it. Something to build for. I can't imagine. And we'll find out who's really for us and who's against us there, because I think we certainly needed to take the 2 weeks off as a break, because that was a lot of football we watched. I'm sorry I'm so challenged when it comes to pronunciation of people's names, but Maria Poblet, right?
Poblet. It's not French.
Poblet, boy, French. Poblet. Okay, there we go. I heard you mentioned Uruguay. You mentioned that the rights of the earth are part of the Uruguayan constitution. Obviously, across the River Plate, I hope I'm saying that right. Yeah. Is that
because of River Plate? It's fine.
River Plate, okay. Right from Argentina, great rivalry. Do you throw your support now to Uruguay?
You know, the first football match I ever watched, I was 9 years old, and I went with my dad. And there was a riot. It was Argentina-Uruguay. And, of course, there's been massive conflicts instigated by colonialism, as usual, but over the river in between the countries as a port and economic center. So it was really tense, and Argentina lost, and there was a riot, and people got killed. But Galeano has said that he supports Argentina.
Mm.
He's actually one of the quotes that he gave about why he supports Argentina and why he views both countries as we're on the same side in the bigger world picture of politics and economic struggles and social struggles. That quote was very inspiring to me in my movement work as we merged a Latino organization and a black organization and looking towards multiracial unity. We used that quote by Galeano, and it talked about how you can see in somebody from a different country your other self, and that may be the most important reason to be alive is that moment where you see yourself in somebody else. And that may be what all of us get when we're actually watching the World Cup. And yes, I will support Uruguay, even though Ghana should have really won that game.
Yeah.
Which is rough. So I'm in solidarity with Ghana as well, and we'll see. Right, coming up next is Paraguay against their former colonial masters.
Mm-hmm.
So let's hope Paraguay pulls one out of the hat.
News. Yes, that would be. I know so many people I noticed on Twitter as the game was in the final stages, they were pretty much just talking about Germany versus Spain.
They'd already looked past Paraguay. Agreed.
And all I've said is that the way I can't imagine saying much about the game in terms of analyzing it on the field, except that we would expect Paraguay to be in something of a defensive shell because of Spain's incredible ball control. But, you know, you never know. A goal could happen. A red card could happen. And Paraguay has some more skill than they're being given credit for right now.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very strong in qualifying in South America. Well, Maria Poblet, a third time's a charm. I think I got it right this time. Thank you so much for joining us here on The People's Game.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you. And
I have a note about actually the Paraguay-Spain game that people may be interested in, just sort of a detail.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that José Luis Chilavert is actually going to be discussing the match on Univision. Chilavert was the Paraguayan keeper who held the world record for quite a while of the most goals ever scored by a keeper. And he was a very interesting political figure who actually refused to, I think it was the Copa America, he refused to lend his presence to his national team in protest for his country hosting a very expensive tournament at a time when it's, you know, based, you know, it was economically devastated. And he was like, this is not where we need to be putting our resources. So he's a real interesting character, and he was a fantastic keeper, and he'll be on Univision. So if you understand Spanish, he'd be a great, obviously, a great perspective to be getting on this match.
And Paraguay, by the way, for people who maybe don't follow the Latin American politics too closely or follow the details of the sort of electoral victories of the so-called pink tide in Latin America, Paraguay mm-hmm. was one of the last countries to sort of join in that wave of the election of left-leaning governments, but that has occurred in Paraguay as well in recent years. And they'll be playing Spain. They'll be kicking off in about 50 minutes. But right now we're going to take a short break, and after the break we're going to take listener phone calls, Jennifer, myself, and Pablo, at 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK. And what we want to talk about basically is the World Cup. We want to know what people out there think about the tournament, what they think about shows like The People's Game here on KPFK, if they want to chime in about that. And we also maybe anything else about the sort of political, economic, and cultural subtext of the world's largest cultural event, the World Cup soccer tournament. So the number is 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. I'm Alan Minsky.
This is Pablo Morales.
And we're joined by Jennifer Doyle on the phone. And the Digital Village will be back next week at its regular time. So call in, and we'll be talking with you soon.
But the answer today is to let all our worries, like a breeze through our fingers, slip away.
Master Blaster by Stevie Wonder. And we've got a bunch of calls coming in. I just want to say, and we're joined on the phone by co-host Jennifer Doyle, who was live in studio yesterday and is home recovering from a bit of a head cold and the million soccer matches we've all watched. I want to let people know that Pablo Morales, who's live in studio with me here, is wearing one of the most beautiful jerseys I've ever seen. It is a Johan Cruyff number 14 shirt from the Los Angeles Aztecs. And that is gorgeous. And Johan Cruyff is one of the most influential people in global soccer over the last, you know, however many millions of years. Because not only is he one of the probably three greatest players in the history of the game, but was highly influential in the development of contemporary soccer. So we're going to be talking to people on the phone here in just 1 second. And Kevin is going to join us on the phone in 1 second. So, Kevin, hold on a second. Calling from San Pedro. And so Spain, Paraguay, your thought here, Pablo?
Oh, my goodness. It's sad that everyone, I think including myself, is kind of looking past this game because, you know, I actually am thinking, I hate prognosticating, but I can't imagine Spain losing this game, but I don't think it's going to be as wide open as Germany and Argentina this morning, that's for sure.
Yeah, and Jennifer, your thought?
I just want to see a good game. That's basically all I really want. I want to see Paraguay, teach us all a lesson about underestimating sides. And they have nothing to lose, and that's always a good place to be in. So I'm rooting for a good game.
Okay, and can we speak with Kevin from San Pedro? Kevin,
hi.
Welcome to to KPFK and the People's Game.
Thank you. Calling from San Pedro, the cultural center of the universe. Last week, as a physician was leaving the room, a Mexican-American physician, he knew I was going to the Irish Fair last weekend. So he turned back and said, "We got France for you guys." And I looked a little puzzled because I'm not a real soccer fan. But I knew Ireland had been kicked out by what they call a handball in soccer. It's illegal to use your hands unless you're the goalie. And this Mali refugee had, not refugee, referee, he should be a refugee. He scored it against Ireland for France. Now, there's a lot of problems here with the French team, as you probably know. There's a lot of dissension. Some of the French people don't feel that the black players on the team of African descent are necessarily representative of the country. I don't know what the hell's going on with the crazy coach. Tell us what is going there. Was it a black player who scored the goal, either of African and immigrant or of African descent? Was that part of the politics? Or why do they only have one referee? Soccer is such a low-scoring game that 1 point means the game sometimes. It's not like baseball where, you know, where the score, you know, an error, a mistake isn't going to necessarily hurt you like in soccer. So the ramifications, please.
Jennifer Doyle, I think this is for you. But let me remind people, first of all, that this is the number to call is 818-985-5735. If you called a few minutes ago and we didn't get you, please call back at 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK to talk World Cup soccer here on KPFK Radio. Jennifer Doyle, your take on France and its national team.
Well, very quickly, just to kind of give a technical perspective to the outsider, which I think our caller is sort of approaching, you know, his questions are coming from the outside. there are actually, I believe, four people in a refereeing role in each game. The center ref, who you see on the field, referees on each of the sidelines, and then a fourth official. When the center ref makes the call, for a goal, he can't really take it. He can't take it back. There's no room for actually questioning certain calls like that within soccer. It's one of the things that makes the sport unique and uniquely prone to certain kinds of controversies. So, with regards to the issues that you raised regarding the French national team, I recommend listeners checking out the very long and detailed and lively and amazing interview we did with Laurent Dubois, who is a historian he's a French historian, and he also has written a book about called Soccer Empire about these issues on the French side. Now, I will say a lot of the kinds of criticism about the nationality of the team were more launched, four and 8 years ago, and that those kinds of questions about French nationality have been replaced by a kind of national sense of denial, whereby more common in French discourse now is to say, you are just French, right? You are not white, you are not black. We are all united by being French, with the exception of just like the very, very, very far right, which will never accept a non-white European, player or a person really as truly French. But the dominant discourse really is this kind of use of everybody is French, and therefore we don't need things like affirmative action. We don't need direct confrontation of the presence of racism within French society. So things are a little bit different than the particular paradigm that you're describing, because things have just sort of changed, I think, maybe in the past 8 years. There's more acceptance of especially people of North African descent as a part of French culture. And I'd actually say one place where people might go to spend some intimate time with one of the great figures, right, of the French player of North African descent who sort of represents this kind of new moment, this kind of new Europe or right. New French person, is Zidane. A 21st Century Portrait, which is a beautiful film that's going to be playing at the Hammer at UCLA in the Billy Wilder Theater on July 6th at 7 o'clock. It's free. You've got to get there early to get online. But I think that just kind of gives you a good moody sort of portrait of the kinds of icons of European football at the moment. So I'm not sure that this answers any of your...
Well, you also forgot to mention a question he had, which was who scored it, and his name was Thierry Henry, who is of African descent. And I think that Jennifer's totally on point by saying that these issues were from several years ago. Nothing changes a country's allegiance to a player than winning a World Cup. And in 98, when the French finally did, suddenly the issue of race became much less important than the cohesion of the team.
And I should say, Henri didn't score that goal, if I remember.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
He handed the ball.
William Gallas.
Gallas scored.
Right. Gallas, who is also a French player of African descent.
So it wasn't really pan-African solidarity. It was just bum refereeing.
Yeah.
But the Mexican-American guy, then he explained it to me. Oh, Mexico beat France. He's pulling for his ancestral homeland as well. Soccer is amazing. Actually, I did see Ireland play Mexico about 20 years ago in the Coliseum. I think there were about three or four Irish fans there. The Irish players were all about a foot taller than the Mexican guys. This was a cigarette company-sponsored tour before cigarette companies weren't allowed to sponsor things. Mm. And the Irish guys were all about a foot taller. The Mexicans just ran circles around them. Ireland just lost. But the amusing thing was, you hear how radical the Mexican fans are. They won't let the other team sleep. They hang out in the hotels all night long chanting. A bunch of Irish people came through the fans, all the fans, which were 99.9 Mexican, and they had this banner about Ireland. And I didn't know what was happening, but I saw people all kind of standing up and laughing. And I couldn't help but laugh, too. They were walking through the fans in the stands, and there were this... I guess they printed it out on computer paper because it must have been, 30, 40, 50, 60 feet long. And it was taken with great good humor and sportsmanship.
What did it say?
Hooray for Ireland or Up okay. Ireland or Erin Abu or something like that. Viva Irlanda. just some, I don't know if this is the custom in Ireland or the custom in soccer. I mean, I just went because I'm Irish descent and I wanted to see the team play. And it was all, by the way, there was an article. In the Times.
And we have to move on to other callers in a second, sir. So, by the way, the number is 818-985-5735. Take your calls about the 2010 World Cup, and we'll try to move quickly. Go ahead, Jennifer.
I just want to say that the Irish U-17 women's team just defeated Germany's U-17 women's team, which is huge news in international women's football.
Right, Germany's a powerhouse there. Well, Kevin, thank you so much for joining us on the People's Game. And now we're going to go on to Carlos in La Mirada. And, Carlos, welcome to the People's Game.
Thank you. I just want to be brief because I know you have a lot of calls. I am Carlos Poblet.
Ah.
My daughter just spoke.
Ah.
And I'm very proud of her. I hope that she's listening. I was a left winger for many, many years. I am not anymore. But I'm very proud of her. And I don't think that politics is the answer. I think it's about love. And I'm a religious man. But I'm very proud of her spirit of solidarity, which is deeply Christian and universal. And we all should aspire to that. And I'm very proud of her.
Did you watch the game today, sir?
Yes, I watched the game. I think that we need two things in life. One is faith and the other one is reason. I think our reason failed, our strategy. When you fight against opponents that are very powerful, as Maria spoke very well about it, as she said it, you have to have a strategy. And I think Maradona is all heart, but there is more strategy in soccer than and other aspects. I mean, he had the faith. I think he had the spirit of the game. He's a great man. He's a genius, too. But methodical, pragmatic approaches sometimes are just as important. And so I think that Maria knows that. And I'm very proud that she has gone so far in her life and developed as a human being. And I hope that she embraces her dream and never gives up.
Well, thank you so much, sir, for joining us here. And
thank you. And I hope Paraguay wins. I'm South American, and I do want Paraguay to win, but I don't hold any grudges against Spain. Our motherland.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here on the People's Game, Carlos. And Pablo has a place where he can tell us about where if you're interested in being surrounded by a bunch of Spanish partisans for today's match against Paraguay. We found a place where they're going to be, I doubt, as many people as were at Alpine Village.
Yeah, well, it's only a 30 chair establishment versus the ballrooms of the. Yeah, but supposedly a great environment to watch Spain is a Bar Pinto. It's on Santa Monica Boulevard in Santa Monica 109, so it's pretty close to the ocean. And I heard that's a tapas bar. So if anyone's up for putting on the red of España and cheering with fellow countrymen, that's supposed to be quite good.
Jennifer, what do you think about who the player of the tournament is yet? I've heard a lot of people say that they now think prohibitively it's Diego Forlan of Uruguay. Schneider's been spoken about. The German team doesn't really have anybody who's standing out right now, but the whole team is really seemingly the
Schweinsteiger.
Schweinsteiger.
I think the buzz on the blogosphere is Forlan and Schneider coming off of yesterday, and the whole German team is what people are saying. And we do have another call we want to get to, so just quickly a thought.
I would love to see people start to notice players that are not strikers, because the strikers can't get the ball unless somebody gets it to them. And so for that reason, I'm going to go for the German player right now for me. For me, it's him, of players who are still in the tournament. So I have soft spots for other players who've been, whose teams were eliminated, and I just think they performed heroically and were really inspiring. But I've got a block on his name, Schweinsteiger.
Schweinsteiger, yeah.
That's my guy.
And Abu in Wisconsin, is that correct? Are we getting a call from Wisconsin? Abu, welcome to the People's Game.
Yes, I'm in the hinterland, but I still listen to this wonderful station. And I have thoroughly enjoyed this past hour.
Thank you.
With a different angle and a local angle, too. Many things have occurred, and I can't add anything profound here. But let me say this. Yesterday when I was watching that game, of course, Ghana was, robbed of a victory. But I thought it was very unbecoming for the crowd to boo when Uruguay were taking the penalty kicks and then cheer when Ghana was. After all, you know, they are the hosts, and they've got to be a little more gracious than, you know, having this thing about, oh, an African team must go to the thing. There's no equal opportunity here. We've got to go on merit. And even so, South Africa has been a wonderful host. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Abu. And you were right on time because our show has to wrap right now. This is Alan Minsky. This is The People's Game. I'm here with Pablo Morales.
Hi. And bye.
And Jennifer Doyle.
Hi. Thanks. That was a great conversation.
And the website, you can check out more information about The People's Game. I'll give in a second. But you can find the archive shows at kpfk.org. Just look on the right-hand column of the front page where it says Pacifica Radio, The People's Game. Click on that. That'll take you to a page where you find another place to click where you can go to all the archives. You can find them all also at www.thepeoplesgame.org, www.thepeoplesgame.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. And we'll be back live on KPFK Monday at 4 p.m. as Strategy Session is also taking the holiday weekend off. Up next, Some of Us Are Brave. And thanks so much to Tamika and Master Control and all of our guests today.
Everyone's feeling pretty. It's our third in July. Though the world's full of problems, they couldn't touch us even if they tried.
Hi, this is LaMonica Peters of The Hutchinson Report, hosted by Earl Lofari Hutchinson. Tune in each Saturday from noon to 1 p.m. for an up-to-the-minute discussion of local and national news events. Be sure to tune in for The White House Desk, an exciting segment of the